Folks, I am really excited to talk about our newest sponsor for the coaching staff, Ruiz Auto Services and Exhaust, also All-American Used Cars and Trucks. Two really, really good businesses. I'm going to start with Ruiz Auto Services and Exhaust. You know, it's hard to find a good mechanic. It's hard to find somebody that you trust. And, you know, long before this situation came about, we had been taking our cars to Ruiz for a year, year and a half, and they've done great, great work. They're honest. They're upfront. They can do everything. They, you know, take care of your motor, take care of your brakes, tires, oil, so simple stuff like oil changes, brake pads, mufflers, whatever you may need. Ruiz Auto Services and Exhaust are going to take care of it for you. If you are in the Omaha area and you are looking for a quality, reasonably priced, customer-friendly situation, you're not going to regret giving Ruiz Auto Services and Exhaust a chance here. They are located at 4839 North 90th Street, Omaha, Nebraska, 68134. You could give Esmeralda a call up there. Her number is 402-317-2572. And they'll get you taken care of. I'm saying this as a customer. We literally do not bring our cars anywhere other than Ruiz Auto Service and Exhaust for anything that we do from this point for the last year or two. So again, another business here, All American Used Cars or Trucks. If you're in the market for a used car or truck, go check out Juan Carlos's business there. 144th and I-80, 14706 Schooner Road here in Omaha. Go check it out here. If you're looking to exchange a car, buy, sell, trade, whatever it may be, you're going to get an honest deal from honest people. So go check out Ruiz Auto Service and Exhaust and All American Used Cars and Trucks. Good afternoon, good evening. My name is Marty Plum, and I am your host of a Pen and a Napkin podcast, a weekly coaching clinic you can carry around with you in your pocket. Welcome back to the coaching staff, episode number 115. And we are proudly sponsored by Ruiz Auto Services and Exhaust, All American Used Cars and Trucks. And I am here in the Pen and a Napkin offices talking to my main man, Mr. Tony Devis, on the line from the Cedar River Valley. Coach Viss, how are we doing this somewhat chilly Sunday evening?
That's exactly it, chilly. It started off a decent day, a little cold, not bad, but it seems like it has, it's gotten worse as the day has gone on. And so that part of it's a little bit concerning, but then I turn around and I look at the calendar and I see it's January 12th and realize it could be a whole lot worse.
I know you're seasoned and experienced, but I would expect you to know that it is January at this point. I mean, I don't want to say too much, but this is one of those. I'm at the point of my life again, seasoned and experienced state. I walk outside. Our daughter went back to college this morning, so tough day for dad to have his yes. little girl leave again. But then I'm helping her pack her car this morning, and I'm like, why do I live here? Why do we live here? What are we doing?
That's a fair question.
You know, but no way, you know, at the same token, I've got a nephew in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and he has had a snow day. I have a niece and nephew who are in Atlanta, Georgia, and they had a snow day, and I have yet to have a snow day here in Omaha, Nebraska. How much sense does that make, Mr. Viss?
It is a wild world that we live in.
Yes, it is. And speaking of wild worlds, we've got a wild assortment of number 15s here. We've got a couple of pretty good quarterbacks between them. You can carry the one. 5 Super Bowls, I think, between Bart Starr and Patrick Mahomes. Thurman Munson, the great Yankee catcher who was taken far too soon with a plane crash. And former American League MVP Dustin Pedroia of the Boston Red Sox. So those are some number 15s in some other sports, but I've got 6 number 15s. All but one of them are retired, but are notable in some way, shape, or form here, Mr. Viss. So what do you got for us?
Well, and 15 is, man, I didn't think we'd have nearly this many. Let's see. Isaiah was 11.
I tell you, one of them played with Isaiah.
Joe Dumars?
No. Very close. It's almost like if you just heated it up for a few seconds, you'd have it.
Vinny Johnson.
There you go.
Microwave.
Yep, that's one of them.
Okay.
The active player is, he's pretty good. He's kind of whole team teaming everybody right now. He's really, really, really good. Yeah, Jokic is number 15. Yep. So that's your active player. This guy had a record, he had a record that is tied by LeBron James this year. Longest career in NBA history.
It's not Bob McAdoo, is it?
Nope.
Oh, yeah.
Went to the same college as Bob McAdoo, the University of North Carolina. Had maybe the best in-game dunk in Olympic basketball history.
Vince Carter.
Vinsanity, yes. Let's see here. This one here, wore 15 in college when he won a national championship as a freshman.
Carmelo
Anthony, yes. And then the last two, let's see here. This number 15 also won a national championship, but he went to UConn. Just recently retired. A year or two ago.
Ray Allen?
Career derailed by knee injuries. Point guard.
I'm struggling on that one.
Kemba Walker. Yeah. Okay. Kemba Walker. And the last one, I couldn't even give you a clue. Hal Greer. I just knew Hal Greer was good.
I would never have got that.
Yeah.
He might have had great clues.
Yeah, we will move on from that one. So two guys here, Vince Carter and Carmelo Anthony. On a side note, Tony, did they overachieve in their careers? Did they underachieve in their careers? Or did they do about what they should have in their careers?
I would see both those guys about what they should have in their careers. Carmelo, one of the best posts up that, you know, we still talk about the Carmelo Anthony move where you catch it and, you know, reverse pivot and then the post area. I mean, that was his unstoppable move. Played unbelievably well in the Olympics. And then Vince just, I mean, kept going and going and going. I think at times Vince might be a little bit underappreciated because primarily known as a dunker, but there was a lot more to his game than just dunking.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of like Tony Viss's game back in the day.
Yeah. Always comes from that nerd group.
I think both guys figured it out as their career went on. It just, they, as Bill Simmons, you know, he talks about the secret of basketball. The secret about basketball is it's not about basketball. And those guys, especially Vince Carter, figured out the secret. It took them past their prime before they figured out the secret. And unfortunately, we never got to see them really understand the secret of basketball when they were at their best as an individual player. You know, it would have been nice to see them do that. They, you know, that's nice.
The other thing I think is kind of interesting with that too, Marty, like you had Vince Carter and Tracy McGrady, and why they broke up their pairing as quickly as they did is a head scratcher, because I thought those two could have been one of the best duos in NBA history.
Yeah. Well, Vince Carter didn't want to pay high tariffs on goods and stuff, you know, up there in Canada, you know, and he forced his way, you know, and both of those guys, they kind of pulled the Jimmy Butler, I'm going to mope and pout and be a pain in the butt until you trade me because I don't want to be here anymore type of a thing. And I think that hurt their legacies as well. you know.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
I agree with that.
One thing I'm sure they did a good job of consistently, or hopefully they did, was defensive transition, which is our topic du jour today. It's the soup of the day here, Tony. I kind of thought about this when I saw, I don't know if you saw the clip, Nate Oates, his team got beat in defensive transition, and boy, did he pop off the bench and call the timeout and really got after a couple of guys and really, chewed their butts, you know, and we've all been there if you've done this long enough where something happens and it is something that, that's the wrong time to make that mistake. Maybe some other time it wouldn't be as big a deal, but today at this moment, that was the wrong time to make that mistake. At the same time, I get where Coach Oates is coming from because, and we're going to kind of break this down in three segments here. We're going to talk about the philosophy of defensive transition, why it's so important. We're going to talk about types of defensive transition. Then we're going to go into some drills here. But to me, and I'd like to start here with this, Tony, to me, defensive transition is nothing more than effort and communication. You can have not a very talented team, but you should be able to control, in large part, defensive transition, especially when you're in 5-on-5 situations on a consistent. Now, if you have a team that's not very skilled and the other team's getting steals and layups because they're pressuring you, obviously that's a different type of defensive transition. I understand that. But, you know, we're talking 5-on-5 and we're getting back. It is about effort and it's about communication. And to me, when I was coaching, it was a pretty big non-negotiable.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about non-negotiables, we talk about things that you can control. And at the top of the list would be attitude. And obviously there's an attitude behind defensive transition. It's a pride thing. And the other one is effort. And that is definitely a big part of defensive transition, is the effort side of things. And so, you know, you just have to have a pride, a mindset. We are going to get back. They may score, but it's not going to be because we jog back defensively. It's not going to be because, you know, we didn't get our foundation set and make them move the ball multiple times. And then the effort it comes down to is just flat out sprinting. And so, you know, those are big things. And like you said, Marty, it's the non-negotiables that you have to play with on a daily basis.
Yeah. You know, when do you, on a yearly basis, Tony, when do you introduce to your team, your defensive transition philosophy? This is what we're going to do on defensive transition, fellas.
Day one, you know, just because of the fact that it really does start right there. I mean, defense starts as soon as the other team rebounds the ball, or as soon as you turn it over, it starts then. And with our style of play and the way that we do things, like we get up into people, we pressure, switch, all that stuff. And so it's very, very important for us day one. It's that mindset. It's one of the opening things that we do, is just to make sure that they understand how hard we have to play. Like that's a huge thing. We want to play harder than every team we play every game, and or at least as hard. And so it's just one of those things where I don't compromise on that one. If you're going to be on the floor for us, you've got to sprint. You've got to get back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was a day one guy. It's that important. I mean, you are going to defensive transition. You know, the average high school game has about 60 possessions. You are going to defensive transition 60 times a game-ish on average. Some games it's going to be 50. Some games it's going to be 70. But you are going to do that a lot. And you cannot give up easy baskets. You just can't. You're not going to survive. You're just not. And so for us, same thing, Tony. We would do that day one. It would be one of the first that we would introduce that before any out of bounds plays. I remember my first year at Fort Calhoun, the first thing, it was a rebuild, of course. And as I'd mentioned, and I'll never forget my first day on offense. This is the one thing we're going to start controlling. Until we learn how to deal with pressure, we have to take care of the ball better. And the first thing we introduced was our press break. And then the second thing that we introduced was defensive transition. So these are the two things we are doing to prevent teams from getting easy baskets against us. We're going to do a better job of handling pressure, and we are going to get back, and we're going to learn how to keep it. And again, like you said, Tony, I think that's a great point. You know, you may score on us, but you're going to score on us the way we want you to score on us in transition, not the way you want to score on us.
Yes. And, you know, basketball, it gets very, very hard to score against a set defense.
Yeah.
I don't think people understand that. Like, one of the things that gets you beat most often is a live ball turnover where you can't get back and get your defense set. You just simply get outnumbered. If you're fortunate enough to steal it off the bounce, wide open layup at the rim. If you rip the guy, if you steal off the pass, maybe it's a 2-on-1, 3-on-2, whatever the case may be. But it's a deal where, as you push the ball down the floor, you know, it's hard when they have a numbers advantage. If you can get back and get your defense set, you've got a chance to be pretty good.
Coaches, I am really excited to announce this year's lineup for our 5th annual Pen and a Napkin Coaches Clinic. This year's clinic date is Saturday, April the 12th. It's going to take place at Mary R. Queen Gymnasium, located at 3405 South 119th Street here in Omaha. We've got 3 on-court demonstrators. Andy King, the head boys basketball coach at Elkhorn North High School, will get the day started with his clinic on developing your team through 5-on-5 controlled scrimmages. Jody Steyer, my good friend from Iowa State University, the associate head coach at Iowa State with the women's basketball team, is going to talk about individual player development in small group settings. Jamie Smith, the head girls basketball coach at Solon High School in Iowa, one of the best I've ever seen, teach about shooting fundamentals, is going to talk to us about how to put together a great shooting workout for your players. Coach Smith won a state championship last year at the Class 3A level in Iowa. Those are 3 on-court demonstrators. Then we're going to have 3 off-court demonstrators. Our lunch keynote speaker is my guy Raz Vanderloo, the head boys basketball coach at Sioux City East High School. And also, Raz is very involved with USA basketball. I'm just going to let Raz cook. He's going to talk to us just with a basketball smorgasbord of topics about what Raz wants to talk about that day. Then we're going to have 2 smaller breakout sessions. Lucas Dollinghouse, the head boys basketball coach at Johnson Brock here in high school, highly successful program. He's also an administrator, and he's going to talk about coaching through an administrator's eyes along with some other things. Our other breakout session is weekday Wade Coulter, the head girls basketball coach at Gretna East High School, and he's going to talk about building a pressure defensive system. One of the great things about the Pen and a Napkin Clinic is, in addition to our presenters, we also have 2 designated breakout sessions where you will get the opportunity to discuss various topics with other coaches attending the clinic. These sessions are a great way to pick the brains of your peers at the clinic, and it's one of the most enjoyable points of our annual clinic. And then, hey, after a long day of learning about hoops, it's time to kick back and relax. We're going to have an optional post-clinic social at Wine 121. It's right down the street from Mary R. Queen, about a mile and a half down the road. I want to thank my friend TK, Tom Crable, for opening his doors to the clinic again. It's just $15 per coach for anybody that wants to join us there. Our Pen and Napkin Clinic is one of the most affordable clinics in America. I mean, it is really, really, really affordable. You're going to get over 7 hours worth of information. That's $60 for a coach. If you're just a singular coach that wants to come up and check it out, it's $60 a coach. If you bring yourself and another coach from your staff, it's $110. 3 coaches from your staff, $150. If you bring 4 or more coaches from your staff, it is only $45 per coach. We've got a sliding scale. It's all about getting better at an affordable price. So if you are interested in signing up for our Pen and a Napkin Clinic, look to the flyer on Twitter and mail it in. You can scan it in. You can do all those different things, or you can DM me on Twitter, or you can email me penandanapkin@gmail.com. Registrations are due by Thursday, April the 10th, 2025. Coaches, do not miss out on one of the best coaching clinics in America. So, Tony, what are some, you know, I had about 4 different ways that I had taught defensive transition throughout my 28 years. I don't know how many different ways that you have done it, or what John is having you do with your group there. So I'll kind of let you lead here. You know, what are some ways that you have taught defensive transition, or and implemented it? And you know, what are you doing now at Kennedy? I mean, you know, just kind of what are different ways that you could do this?
Yeah, there's a variety of ways. One that I really like a lot, one year, a guy at Snow Valley was given a clinic and he had defensive transition and he made up the drill on the fly. I remember him saying that after it was done, and it was a continuous 2-on-2 defensive transition drill. So what you did is you had an inbounding line, you had two lines on the side, you know, on the sidelines, and then you put two defensive guys at the free throw line on the other end, and then they're going to have an inbounding line on the other end and two lines on the opposite sideline. And so what would happen is when the guy on the sideline would pass the ball to the first line on the sideline, the defensive transition would start. And so one guy would have to sprint back, get the guy in the second line, and then the other guy would get the trailer. And so you had to start by sprinting, because if you don't sprint, it's a layup on the other end. And so you've got to sprint back, get matched up quickly, and then make sure you get that trailer. And then what we would do is once the ball hit the rim or the backboard, the other end is going. So you're going to play offense, then you're going to play defense, then you're going to rotate out. That's mm-hmm. kind of the gist of the drill. And we would do that. We'll put 5, 7, 8 minutes on the clock, depending upon where we are in the season. And the thing that the guys figure out in that drill, and I think it's the most important drill for us early on, is how hard you have to sprint back. Because if you don't sprint back, it is a layup on the other end. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that it also works is the communication piece of it, because the guy is dribbling in for a wide open layup. If you're his partner, you don't want to jog in and pat him on the back and tell him nice layup. You're starting to go back as he dribbles in. If you see he's got a wide open layup, you're already starting to sprint back so you can get the ball stopped. But I think it's a really, really good drill from that standpoint. Continuous 2-on-2 defensive transition that works out really well. Other ways that we teach it, you know, we'll start off 3-on-3, but and eventually we'll build it to 5-on-5 with the chaser. So you've got, and I'm sure you've done this with Marty, you've got the five lines on the baseline, you have the five lines, free throw line extended. Yeah. The guy that you throw it to on the baseline, the guy that's across from him at the free throw line extended has to touch the baseline. Now you've got kind of a 5-on-4 situation with a trailer. And this one is great because, again, you are not guarding the guy that you're across from because they have an advantage already. And so what you have to do is you have to be flexible and shift and switch. And then the thing that we tell the defense that you're trying to do to that guy that's getting back is you're giving them the weak side wing because that's the least dangerous player on the floor. Yeah. And so you've got to get, you know, matched up, you point things out, you got to sprint back, you build your foundation, so to speak. But those two, I'll just start with those and then kind of let you give a chance to give some of yours as well before I throw in there another one or two. But anyway, those two to me, those are our foundational pieces. Those are the two most important defensive transition drills that we do.
Yeah, we call that free throw transition, that one, or not free, I'm sorry, not free throw transition. We call it call the name. Transition. Now I saw, and I put this on a 2-minute drill a few weeks ago, shameless plug. I was at Craig Doty's practice before they played Creighton, and they did that drill. But what they did, they took the guy in the middle. So they had two on one side, two on the other side. And then the guy that would be in the middle right underneath the basket, they moved him up to the free throw line. And they had a defender with him at the free throw line. So they never called that guy's name that was guarding the guy at the nail, but they would always call one or two of the wing players. And I thought, man, that's really good, you know, because, you know, what do you want to take away as well? That rim runner, right? You know, so they would put their post player at that nail. And they're also emphasizing in their own scheme, hey, rim run, get here, try to get that early seal, especially if you're one-on-one, you know, type of thing there. We did a lot of, you know, two or three of our favorites, like I said, call the name, which, you know, kind of a universal drill. We called it 5-on-3+2. So we would have five offense going against three defense, And then as soon as the ball got across half court, two people would come in from the side and they would have to touch the the middle. So we would start the five on the baseline, the three at half court, and then we would pop the ball to somebody, and then the three would have to get back. You know, you know, usually we get into a triangle, you know, take away layups, you know, and that type of thing. And then we would rotate those two in and they would come in and we'd have to get match up in the scramble and that type of thing there. That's another one that we did. One other one. And then I'll bounce it back to you for a couple more of yours. We did something called 6-4 transition. And I picked this up at I think it was USA Basketball deal. So we would take six players, let's say, three green, three yellow in honor of the Kennedy Cougars. All right.
Thank you.
Yeah. And we would put them underneath the basket. So three green, three yellow. We would take a green and a yellow and put them at one volleyball post, a green and a yellow, and put them at the other volleyball post. And then we would take the ball and we would throw it up to the rim or slam it on the floor, whatever, create a loose ball situation. And whichever team got the ball, they were going on offense to the other end. And if the defense, you know, let's say the green got the ball and the yellow ends up, you know, picking their nose, you take it, you pop it up, and now you got a 2-on-1 instead of that. And sometimes, and we have another one here that I'll talk about. But we, you know, it's a great way. Okay, there's no preset who has the ball, the green or the yellow team. Whoever gets it, now we're going, we're turning and burning. You know, sometimes you pop it to somebody, like you've got them moving around in a circle, and you just give it to somebody, and you can kind of tell that they've got an advantage. Like if they're smart, they've got it, they take it on advantage, they go the other way. And now it's 3-on-2 because everybody's behind them just for that split second. But, you know, just different ways to do that. That's another one that we did that I really, really like that.
I like that one too. Some others that we would do one, we want to try to implement as many things as we could. So we put two guys in the corner on offense, a guy at the top of the key on offense. We'd have three guys in the lane and we'd make them kind of do, circles in the lane. And then they would call out who they have to block out. So eventually I'd kick to one of those spots. They got to shoot the three. Our rule rebounding wise, if you're below the free throw, you go for the rebound. If you're above the free throw, you get back on defense. And so those are kind of a rules for offensive rebounding. Well, the shot goes up. Whoever shoots it, if the defense grabs it, whether they make or miss it, they have to touch the end line. And now you're in a 3-on-2 out of a live situation, which I think is a little bit more game-like than somebody touching the end line and having to sprint back. That was a one that we do a lot that incorporates a little bit more than that, makes a little bit more game-like. And the other one that we like to do a lot too is we'll do 5-on-5, pass the ball around, whether you're running a set, and all of a sudden I'll yell switch. They got to put it on the floor. Offense or defense is going to turn to offense, grab the ball. And the rule is you cannot guard who is guarding you.
Yeah.
And that's a really good one too, that helps work on communication as well.
Mm-hmm. One of my favorites that we did was, we called it Nuggets Drill. And I forget why I call it the Nuggets Drill. Maybe Mike Malone, I saw him do it. I don't know. So, but we would start kind of the same thing that we did in that 5-on-3+2 type of a thing, but in a different way. So we would have, we would line up the offense on the free throw line on the opposite end. So they got to go 75 feet, okay? And maybe sometimes we would move it up to the volleyball line. Maybe sometimes we move it to half court, whatever it may be. We would have three or two or four defensive players inside the lane, and we would take whatever, let's say we had three defensive players inside the lane. I would tell, okay, and you kind of have some fun with it, Billy, you go here, stand here. Frank, you got to go over here. And sometimes we would put them like, you have to touch the wall at the back end there. So it's going to take them like four or five seconds, or if they're me, 8 or 9 minutes to get into the play, but they've got to run a long way. Sometimes you take it, you really start goofing around and you take them, put them out of bounds or whatever, But, you know, you create these weird situations where they've got to hustle in. And you, again, you've got that split second advantage to talk. And your job, again, on defense is to prevent them from getting an easy shot. No layups and no open threes. That was kind of our rule. First thing we said was, and we'll get into philosophies and types of transition here, but, you know, play inside out, everything like that. So, you know, how are we going to prevent that layup? And sometimes, like I said, if you put them in, and you had them put a hand on the wall, it was going to take them 5 seconds or so to really get matched up and find somebody, you know. So that was a distinct advantage for the offense, and the defense really, really had to work to prevent them from getting an easy look. So Nuggets drill was another one that we did a lot of, and I really, really like that one, Tony, especially the way that we played at Fort Calhoun the last couple of years, where we shifted into we smothered and denied really, really hard. We could kind of transition into different types of defensive transition here, where shot would go up. Whoever got the rebound, we would smother them hard with one person. We would try to find the nearest outlet with one person. And if you weren't smothering or denying, you were getting back. And then once we figured that out, then you could kind of trap and rotate after that, because we were really ultra aggressive. We wanted to create offense from our defense. And we knew there was going to be situations where there might be two or three kids back there for 3 or 4 seconds, and we've got to figure out how to stop that. Now, we felt like over the span of 32 minutes, we would exchange that 2 points for the 6 or 8 points that we would create on the other end. That was part of the method to the madness, to the analytics of it. But that Nuggets drill was a really, really good way for us to teach that and to help our kids understand what we were trying to do.
It sounds good. I've heard of teams pressing off of misses, if you will.
Yeah.
And, you know, I myself have never done that. Not that one's right, one's wrong. I was very, very intrigued by it. Just never committed to doing it. But I've known some coaches who have, you know, like yourself, and obviously have had a lot of success with it.
Well, and it was, you know, now you got to have a couple of things. You have a really athletic team, and you got to be deep. You have to, and you know, and it's part of the, hey, 8 or 9 of you really deserve to play. And so this is what we're going to do. But it also takes, a lot of people probably look at it and go, they're crazy. That's just a bunch of undisciplined kids and stuff, and they're running around and that type of thing. When in actuality, it took a lot of discipline, in my opinion, because...
more organization.
Yeah. Well, you know, we you know, 5 different shots could go up, and you could have 5 different kids smothering the ball, you know, and you could have 5 different kids covering the outlet, and you could have, you know, how many different combinations of kids getting back. And what we struggled with initially, because, and it was a great problem to have, what we struggled with initially was the kids so wanted to get up and pressure, we would have like 2 smothering, 2 denying, and 1 lonely kid back there, you know, kind of like the way I felt in elementary school on the playground, just kind of all by their lonesome with nobody to hang out with, you know.
Well, like,
but you know, we did a lot of film. We talked through it, and we really had to explain, hey, look, we're smothering to slow it down so you can get back. But once you've established that you've gotten back and we've taken care of that, then you can come back up. Then you can come back up, and then we can look to trap and rotate and cause some problems here. And I feel like, you know, it was, I felt good about it. We scored a lot of points. We won a lot of games. And it was a good system. I firmly believe in it. It's something, you know, going way back to my early days with Mike Power and Jamie Sale at Briar Cliff. That's what we did. And we led the nation in scoring a couple of years. And we won a lot of basketball games doing things like that, you know. But you have to have a certain personnel with it as well. So I get that. But that was kind of the method behind the madness, you know. I don't know. I mean, was I crazy or not, Tony?
I've seen a lot of coaches. Mike Hilmer is a legendary boys coach here in Iowa, and I know Mike had pressed a decent amount off of misses as well. And no, I think it's good because, you know, when you know you're going to get pressed and get organized, your chances of breaking the press are much better than, you know, if you miss a shot Your team misses a shot, you eventually, or immediately, I'm sorry, go right into a press. The other team's not as ready for that. They don't get their personnel squared around and different things like that. So, no, I like it. I just, like I said, I don't know if I ever had the courage to do it, but I'm very interested in it.
Yeah. What are some other ways you've actually executed? Like, what are some of the rules that you have implemented with your transition over the years, Tony?
You know, I kind of talked a little bit about it during the rebounding thing. You know, we just talk a lot about rebounding in terms of the fact that, hey, if you're below the free throw, go get it. If you're above the free throw, get back. And so that's kind of how we would differentiate it with that. And so that's one of the ways that we do that. And I've seen teams, to be honest with you, that don't really put a ton of emphasis on offensive rebound. And so when the shot goes up, all five guys get back. And so I've seen that one. And I've seen some people just go for broke where, you know, they send either four or all five guys to go get the board. And so I've seen it a lot of different ways. You know, I guess I would say I'm obviously a little bit partial. Below the free throw, go get it. Above the free throw, get back. And we're not the tallest team in the world. You know, we start only one guy over 6 foot tall on our sophomore boys team. And we get, I believe, almost every game we've gotten double-digit offensive rebounds. And so, you know, I like that. And I know some teams have had a lot of success in pulling in offensive rebounds. And one of the things we talk a lot about is, hey, most teams on their first attempt of shot out of four are hitting one out of four. But if they get that offensive rebound, they're hitting three out of four. And I know this isn't the difference between, you know, we're not switching gears and going from defensive transition to offensive rebounding. But I think that's where your defensive transition begins, is that philosophy of offensive rebounding.
Yeah. Well, you know, for some teams, their best offense is chuck it up at the rim and then go get it. You know, and you know, like Texas A&M, you know, Buzz Williams, the last 2 or 3 years, I mean, they are just highly intense about going. You know, Izzo, had a long stretch there at Michigan State where that's where they created a lot of their offense as well. So it makes sense. And I've kind of done it two or three different ways. Like I said, we did the smother and deny. When I started it at Fort Calhoun, we just went five back. Like our tallest girl is, we had one girl and she was just Bria was just a freshman at the time. You know, she was 5'10", 5'11". So it's like, okay, but when in doubt, get back. Cause we are not going to get any offensive rebounds anyway. I always called that the Princeton, you know, Pete Carril. We're just gonna, you know, and you know, we're not going to get a lot of offensive rebounds anyway. So why spend and exert a lot of energy, doing that, you know? And you got to find what works for your team. Like, for some teams, they designate crashers, four and fives crash, or three, four and five, you crash, one and two, you get back no matter what. Above the free throw line, below the free throw line. That was another one I had listed as well, Tony. For me, I always wanted to just be more aggressive. I always felt like the game was geared towards if you have the ability to be more aggressive than your opponent, then you should be. Now, again, not every team has that ability. Like I said, when I took over at Fort Calhoun, we didn't have the personnel, and it's not the kids' fault. You know, it's just they're. Physical abilities didn't match exactly what we would like to do, so you adapt and you go to their strength. And our strength at that time was, let's get five back, let's try to be really disciplined on defense, and let's work things that way there. And you know, the kids did a great job with it. I'm really proud of them. All 4 years, I'm really proud with everything that we did and what the kids did, especially. So, but I, for me, Tony, I didn't really want them to think very much. You know, where am I at? Okay, am I here? You know, how do you handle that gray area? You know, when in doubt, do what?
When in doubt, get back.
Okay.
You know, because if you're doubting yourself, like, I'm not quite sure where I'm at here, you're already kind of tiptoeing and hesitating. And so you're probably not going to get it. So go ahead and get back. That's kind of what we do there. And when you were talking about, you know, three, four, and five, you'll get it. One and two, get back. It reminded me when Tim Floyd was at Iowa State, he did what was called 5-on-5 post exchange. And so what would happen is when the shot would go up, one and two would sprint back. One of them would end up in the lane. The other one would end up around half court. And that way they could, you know, the half court player would jam up the break and the guard that was in the lane would not leave the lane until a post player got back and freed them up to get out of the lane. And so we had implemented that policy, that philosophy a little bit as well. But I liked what you said there in terms of it's got to fit your personnel. You know, in college, you mentioned some teams there, Michigan State, Texas A&M, they can obviously recruit a certain type of kid that fits what they want to do. In high school, it's very important to be flexible and pliable and make sure that what you're doing fits your personnel.
Last thing here, Tony, how much on average are you working on defensive transition?
I'll be honest, early in the year, it's probably 12 to 15 minutes, almost every practice. And by the end of the year, we lop 15 minutes off of practice January, then we lop another 15 off February. I'd read that in a wooden book one time about the importance of keeping your legs and mind fresh and things like that. And so we would do that. So towards the end of the season, it's probably, I don't know, 7 to 10 minutes of defensive transition. But it is an everyday thing. Defensive transition, closeouts. I mean, there's things defensively that I don't think you compromise. And those would be two at the top of the list.
Yeah, that's the same for me. It was, we're going to close out in some way, shape, or form 5 to 10 minutes every day. Defensive transition, you know, day before a game, 5 to 7. If we can, 7 to 10. You know, early in the season, 15 to 20. I mean, I felt like it was that important. I mean, I was, you know, whatever it is, whether we're sending five back or we're sending, you know, we're doing the smother, deny, and rotate. And being really ultra aggressive, I wanted to make sure that we were on the same page at all times. Because again, whatever you're doing, the you know, one of the ways that you can control the game as a coach is you can try and implement things to prevent your opponent from getting as few of easy baskets. I ain't got no good English all of a sudden, Tony. You're trying to prevent them from getting as many easy baskets as you can. And I think that is something that is so very, very controllable.
Yes. If you can get back and make them make multiple passes and, you know, try to force them to reverse the basketball, you know, and hopefully you can lock it on the side. But if you can do that stuff, you can really make yourself tough to defeat, irregardless of the talent level separation. If you can get back defensively and make them earn it, your chances of winning go dramatically up.
Coaches are absolutely loving our Taking Over a New Program booklet. As many of you know, I spent 2 years outside of coaching, and during that time, I hung a note card in my workspace at school that said, "Strip the house down to the studs." I took that time to really rethink and reorganize my thoughts on what it takes to run a transformational program. As I prepared for the possibility of coaching again, I organized these thoughts into this 96-page booklet. How much do I trust this booklet? I used this booklet as I went on interviews to help sell myself and my vision for what my new program would look like. If I'm using it to sell myself, why wouldn't I recommend it to you, my listeners? This booklet will help you look at any part of your program, no matter what stage you're at in your program, and help improve it in some way. It's all yours for only $15, which includes shipping and handling. For more information, email me at apenandanapkin@gmail.com. Well, Tony, you know who earns it every time that they go out and perform in front of all of us.
Every concert, Europe.
Tony, it is your turn for trivia. What do you have for me, my man?
And one that is hot off the press, Marty.
Oh, boy.
Today, Pitt came back from 32 points down to defeat SMU in women's NCAA basketball. My question, what is the record for a comeback in women's Division I NCAA basketball?
I believe that's it. It's 32 points. Didn't they tie the record today?
There you go. They tied it. I want to say the previous was back in 2006, if I remember correctly. So it was a record that had stood for about 18 years and then was tied today by Pitt and SMU.
Yeah. What's the biggest lead that you gave up and what's the biggest lead that you ever came back from, Tony?
Honestly, Marty, I do not know the answer to those. I know we were up double digits. I don't know where double digit wise and got beat. And I also know that we were down double digits and came back and won, but I could not tell you specifically what the numbers are. Mm-hmm. How about you?
Unfortunately, I'm more of a sadist than you are. I remember these things. Beatrice, 1 year, we were up, I want to say 17, in the third quarter, and they just, all of a sudden, they just couldn't miss. They just couldn't miss. And they had a nice team. I mean, we probably played one of our best 20-minute stretches that entire season to get up that big. They had a kid that ended up going Division I to Washington State. She was really, really talented. That one ate at me. And then I think the biggest lead we ever erased was probably, I can't, probably 13 or 14. The most memorable one was when I was at Fort Calhoun. We played, it was a big rivalry game, and we were down 9 with 50 seconds left, and they had the ball, and we won in regulation.
Wow.
Yeah. That was pretty crazy. That was nuts. That was pretty crazy. I would even say that if our guy Mel Allen were in the gym and he were announcing that game when that final buzzer went off, he would have said,
"How about that?"
So, Tony, let's talk a little NBA here to start out here. Huge game this past week, Cleveland against Oklahoma City, or Oklahoma City at Cleveland. First time in NBA history that two teams with over 30 wins and 5 or less losses matched up against each other. First time in NBA history that both teams came in with a double-digit winning streak, and Cleveland comes out with the win. It was a game that lived up to the hype. I think more and more I am believing, especially not so much with Oklahoma City. I don't think they've caught anybody off guard, but Cleveland might be the real deal here.
Yeah, I'm looking more and more with Cleveland. Like, Boston might not have the cakewalk to the NBA Finals that I initially thought, and I think New York is also kind of finding their way as well. Mm-hmm. But like I said, I think Boston may not have the cakewalk that I think that they had. Cleveland will be a very worthy opponent if those two square off in the playoffs.
Yeah. Well, they've got good balance and depth. You know, Evan Mobley is playing great right now. He's averaging, I'm looking at their stats right now, 19 and 9, 3 assists, a block and a half a game. He's been really good. Darius Garland has bounced back. He's averaging 21 a game. Donovan Mitchell doesn't have to carry nearly as much as the offensive load as he has before. They've had a couple of nice signings. Ty Jerome has been great for him. Georges Niang, Iowa State, has been really, really good. You know, so they've got some really, really good pieces, and they are well on their way to being the number one seed in the Eastern Conference. I'm going to look this up here. They're up 5.5 games on the Celtics. They are on pace to win 72 or 73 games, Tony, which puts them in rarefied air.
Yeah, both teams at the time when they played were on pace to win over 70. And there was an interesting article, and I wish I could find it and remember all the details, but it was like trade scenarios for each NBA team. And the trade scenario they had with Cleveland, I cannot remember who they wanted him to get, but it was to move Niang and a couple other pieces for this player. And, you know, it was one of those things where, you know, they're like, hey, I don't know if you quite have enough to get Boston. If you make this trade, you may. It's a swing for the fence type thing. But yeah, Cleveland is very, very intriguing.
Yeah. Well, but then do you mess with what's working that well? You know, that's the, you know, do you disrupt the locker room? You know, that's the other question you ask.
And that's the thing. I think sometimes we do those trade machines or whatever that you don't know what the locker room's like. And if you were to get rid of a George Niang, who has been in a variety of different places and has raved as a great teammate by all these different locker rooms, would it mess up your locker room to get rid of him? And there was like two or three guys that were moving for this one player. And I wish I could remember. I think it was an NBA power rankings, a trade that each team should make type thing.
Yeah. Well, we're going to see the rematch Thursday. They're playing it in Oklahoma City. It's going to be on TNT. So it should be a great matchup. And one of the big things, part of the calculus here that is not included in this, of course, is Chet Holmgren is not back yet for Oklahoma City, nor will he be back for the next one here. It would be interesting to watch, you know, Hartenstein and Holmgren for OKC go at it with Mobley and Jared Allen for the Cavs. So that does change the calculus a little bit.
And then Alex Caruso didn't play either.
Yeah.
And so OKC, no reason to panic. I don't think Cleveland's getting too high on this. They just saw some comments after the game that they would not have won that game a year ago. And that says a lot about Kenny Atkinson and what he's done in Cleveland. I think Kenny would tell you that he's taken a lot of things that he learned at Golden State and implementing those with the Cavs. But the Cavs are a definite threat to make the finals, if not win the whole thing this year.
Mm-hmm. As we enter into this holiday season, coaches, you know what would make a great gift for you this year? It would be a copy of Kings of Their Court, the story of the 2020-2021 season here in Omaha, three ranked teams in the top 25 in the country. And you're going to hear the personal and professional stories of players like Hunter Salas and Chucky Hepburn, Frankie Fiddler, William Kyle, coaches like Tim Cannon, Josh Ludke, and Doug Woodard. Yeah, just a terrific, terrific story, a crazy time period in our country with quarantine, politics, George Floyd, and everything in between. Yours for only $19.99. Go to Amazon, go to books, look up Kings of Their Court, and order a copy of that today. It's going to be a great stocking stuffer for you, for somebody that you love. Tell your wife, tell your spouse, tell your kids, hey, I would love to have a copy of this book and have something to read here and to just read about a great basketball story. Kings of Their Court, available on Amazon.com today. Paolo Banchero, Tony, coming back here, the Magic have been able to tread water since both him and Franz Wagner, the missing you know, the case of the mysterious torn obliques in Orlando. Stay away from Disney World, Tony, if you don't want anything bad to happen to your stomach area. They have tread water. They are in, I believe, fourth place in the Eastern Conference here. And, you know, this kind of gives them a boost to kind of get themselves, you know, do they have enough here to make a run here and maybe get up, you know, at least solidify hosting in the first round of the playoffs and maybe try and get in that 2-3 spot. By, you know, it's going to be tough for them to catch the Celtics, but they could catch New York and get in that 2-3 situation with Boston. Just take a young franchise taking steps, and now they're getting their best player back.
And they needed it, because I'm looking here, it says in their last 10, they were 4-6 without their two cornerstone pieces. And one of the things that's interesting, because, you know, Wagner's going to be out for a number of more weeks yet, are they active on the trade front? You know, that might not be the worst thing in the world. You're going to get Paolo back, which obviously is a huge piece, but could you get something else to try to, you know, to try to stay within pace of New York, or do you just keep kind of wait until Franz is back?
You know, it's that art of building a team. It's not the science. They've got the young core. Jalen Suggs has come into his own. KCP has been a good quality veteran presence. Jonathan Isaac, kind of more of a vendor, but they got Anthony Black, Cole Anthony. You know, how much do they let this organically grow? That'll be a key question. And you know what? That's why those guys in Orlando get paid the big bucks, and that's why we don't.
They were talking about being disappointed in Cole Anthony and that he might be on the trade block to try to get something in there.
Mm, okay. All right. Well, hey. Let's see what happens. The big thing I want to talk to you about this week, Tony, in our TWIB segment, it's been all over the place. Mick Cronin coming out. His team got beat at Nebraska, highly competitive game. They didn't shoot it well. Some of that was Nebraska's defense. Some of that was just missing some good looks, which happens in the game. It kind of threw some shots at the Nebraska crowd on the way out. But then the next game, they hosted Michigan, and Michigan came in and beat them up pretty bad. I think they scored like 94 points. And he called his team soft publicly. Yeah, he really got after the kids in that way. And then they went and played Maryland, and he got kicked out of the game because of the officiating. Mm-hmm. It's been a bad week for Mick Cronin. Let's just leave it at that. Where are we at? Because I saw another thing here, Tony, and it wasn't on the original list, but Rick Barnes mentioned something after their game. I think they played Texas yesterday, and a kid made a mistake, and he told the kid when he came out of the game, that's the play that you get paid to make, or something like that. And it's a different world that we're now living in. So with this semi-professionalism, if not somewhat professionalism, of college athletics officially, do coaches have a little bit more of a license to publicly hold their players accountable in this way? Do you agree with what Cronin and by proxy Barnes are doing here? How do you handle these type of situations? I want to kind of dive in on this one here, buddy.
I would say this. You mentioned Mick's had a rough week. I think Mick's had a rough season. I'm just going to be honest. There have been a few incidents before the most recent ones. Mm-hmm. And if Mick is trying to put a guide out there about how to get fired, I think this is it. and so as I look at things with this, I've always wondered, like when Mick went out there from, I believe he came from Cincinnati, if I remember correctly. I think that was a job before UCLA.
Yep.
I thought Mick's stuff played well at Cincinnati, underdog, as far as things go, tough town, blue collar. I thought that went pretty well with Cincinnati. I don't know if it goes as well with Los Angeles at UCLA. A different, I don't know if clientele is the right word that I'm looking for, but just different. And so I don't know, because he's had some success there. He had changed some culture pieces and things like that. Might get more and more coaches are getting more and more frustrated with NIL and different things like that. We've seen coaches like Jim Larrañaga and Tony Bennett leave, citing that as a reason. But I don't know. I mean, they're still 19, 20, 21, 22-year-olds. I can see if they're in the NBA and they're getting paid, tens of millions of dollars. They're getting hundreds of thousands, some cases millions.
Yeah.
But I just don't know if that putting a young person under that much strain and under that much pressure. And I think Rick's wasn't as egregious as Mick's.
Yeah, it wasn't as blatant.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think it's good to come out like that publicly. Now, if you want to, and we've both been there, Tony, we've gotten after our teams in the locker room or the meeting room or the film room, whatever you want to call it. There is absolutely, I don't care what anybody says, there is a time and a place for that. And if you disagree with me, so be it. But I think when your effort is not there, or when you're, again, the control the things you can control. And when your effort isn't there, you can control that. You get called out. When your communication isn't there, you can control it. You call it out. Your concentration, you know, those were the three big ones for me: effort, communication, concentration. We control those things. If you do that, then it's up to me to teach you the game better. And I was really blessed for the vast majority of my career. I had kids that did that. But you never do it publicly as much as you want to. Mick Cronin felt better about that afterwards. But, you know, I can't remember who said it. You know, when you do stuff like that, you feel better. And everybody, it's like throwing up. Everybody, you feel better, but everybody else around you feels worse. And they're, you know, whatever it may be, you know. And again, hard lessons that I had to learn in my career. You keep your post-game comments short, especially if you're frustrated. You know, one of the best lessons that I learned, and for the most part, I stuck to it after a few years. When you're upset after a game, hey, look, I don't have a lot of good things to say right now. I'm going to watch the film. Let's talk about it tomorrow. Let's get out of here. You know, because you can do a heck of a lot more damage when you say something emotional. Not to say I was perfect at it, without a doubt. Wasn't perfect, but I would say the same thing. I mean, if you're an NBA coach or if you're an NFL coach, if you're dealing with grown men in their late 20s and early 30s, and you really know your team, if you're Phil Jackson coaching Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen and those guys, then you can play that stuff. But I think publicly you have to put a good face on it, and then you take care of that stuff behind closed doors. That's where I'm at.
Yep. Praise in public, criticize in private. I think that's a good rule of thumb.
Yep. Tony, I got one question for you. This is kind of what I got for you here. Who's moving up for you, Tony?
I'm going to go with Doug Christie and the Sacramento Kings. I was not a fan, still not a fan of how it went down with Mike Brown, but I am happy for Doug Christie and the Kings. They seem to have things headed in the right direction as they've won 7 games in a row. And again, they've gotten to an easier part of their schedule, but where that thing was, it was a dumpster fire. And they have, we're sitting 6 games below 500 and now are a game above and sitting in the play-in game in the West.
Yeah. How much will this be the new coach bump, Tony? We'll have to see. We have to let it play out. But yeah, I didn't realize that they had won 7 in a row since they made it. Like you, I agree with you. How they did it was not appropriate. But they're playing good ball right now, and they've re-engaged De'Aaron Fox. I know that was probably a big part of their thought process because he has not committed long-term to them. Now, the debate is, you know, is De'Aaron Fox good enough to be the number one guy on a championship level team? Well, I think he's really, really good. Is he that good? I don't know. But they have definitely, like you said, Tony, they have turned things around. Doug Christie, getting things going there. Is his wife still at the games? When he makes a good play call, you remember how he used to do that thing to signal to her when he calls a good play? Does he still do that?
I don't think so, but I could be wrong.
Okay. All right. My up this week is the Purdue Boilermakers, the men's team at Purdue. The Plums sat around and watched the Boilermakers kick the holy snot out of the Cornhuskers here today, 104-68. They were absolutely on fire. I don't think they, at one point, I think they shot, like, they were shooting 69% from the field, and 61% from the 3-point line. I mean, it was just absolutely insane. They have won 5 Big Ten games in a row. All of them, their closest margin of victory in those games has been 18 points. So they are really, really rolling right now. I think some people forget that they played in the national championship game last year, and they've got some pretty important pieces back from that team. So hats off to Matt Painter. they are playing really, really well right now. So who's down for you, Tony?
You know, I'm not really sure where I'm going to go with this one. I was thinking about going SMU because that's the team that blew the 32-point lead. Yeah. But when you said the Purdue Boilermakers, I've been watching some of their women's scores lately, and they frankly are not competitive. They are, I believe, 0-5 in the Big Ten, and it's not close. I mean, they are getting blown out. And again, the Big Ten women, the conference is loaded this year, and I think they played their fair share of ranked teams in the conference. But those would probably be I'm going to double down and go with both SMU and the Purdue women.
Okay. My down is the Toronto Raptors professional basketball team. They are in their earlier today. They are 1-15 in their last 16 games. There's a headline on ESPN.com right now. Cade Cunningham's triple-double leads Pistons to a 123-114 victory over slumping Raptors. Slumping doesn't even begin to describe it. Slumping is like in baseball, if you go 1-20, this is a Sahara Desert right now. This is not a slump. This is not good. Before I did this, I wanted to double check and make sure. But RJ Barrett, you know, some of these players that they're putting a lot of stock in, to be kind of cornerstones moving forward, they're healthy. They're playing. RJ Barrett is playing. Scotty Barnes is playing. I know Grady Dick is only in his second year, but he's playing, you know. In the case of like Orlando, they're young. You know, when Banchero was playing, they were winning. When Franz Wagner, was playing, they were winning as young players. The Raptors are not winning right now, and I'm just kind of wondering in what direction are they going to go here. So that's who I'm down on right now, Tony.
Okay. Yeah. You know, after they traded Pascal Siakam at the trade deadline last year, you know, and then that was one of the guys they had talked about during that trade article that I read, was Bruce Brown will be an interesting piece, and they believe Toronto will move him.
Yeah, yeah. There's no reason to keep him right now. He needs to find a place somewhere other than Toronto. That's for sure. So,
Southern Los Angeles.
Oh, yeah. There you go. Clippers or Lakers?
Lakers.
Oh, okay. All right. You getting out the trade machine, Mr. Viss?
Eventually. Yeah. We're getting close to that deadline, less than a month.
Yes,
it'll be interesting to see.
Yep, it will be. So, episode number 115, defensive transition. A lot of great stuff here. Again, this was kind of inspired by the clip of Nate Oates kind of getting after one of his fellas. Again, effort and communication. You're not going to be perfect in defensive transition, but if you want to go from bad to average, from average to good, from good to great, defensive transition has to be a big part of the formula, in my opinion. And I think it's something that, again, even if it's late in the season, even if it's February 10th, you need to take 7 to 10 minutes every day, if possible, to work on your defensive transition and just keep emphasizing. That's my parting shot here. Tony, what do you got?
I don't know if it's the biggest foundational piece, but it is the first foundational piece of your defense.
Yep. So, all right. Well, hey, Tony, how many games you got this week?
Just two.
Ah, backing off on the NBA four game schedule last week.
Yeah, we're going back to more of the high school.
Yeah, there you go. You know, you've proven what you can do with that. Now we'll come back with the mere mortals. So episode 115, defensive transition. Hope you folks have enjoyed it. Again, want to thank our sponsor, Ruiz Auto Services and Exhaust, and All American Used Cars and Trucks. Want to thank Juan Carlos and everybody there with those businesses and all that they're doing for a pen and a napkin. So hope you folks have enjoyed this podcast. Coaches, as always, let's be sure to hone our craft one day at a time.